Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. It's called the Political Industrial Complex, and the star's Dave Helling this weekend raised all sorts of questions about how much political consultants are paid and the impact their work has on the lawmakers they elect. Today, our pundits are back to talk about consultants, the downward spiral of President Barack Obama, the upcoming Kansas and Missouri legislative sessions, and a pair of Kansas races that might spur just a little bit of interest. These are races for the U.S. Senate and for governor. They're both next year. Lots to talk about, lots to think about. Our pundits today, the aforementioned Dave Helling of the Kansas City Star. David, good morning.
Great to be here.
Burdette Loomis is a political scientist at the University of Kansas. Bert, always good to have you.
Thanks, Dave.
And from Missouri State University in Springfield, the always prescient, all-knowing political scientist, George Conner. George, good morning to you.
Good morning, Steve, Bert, and Dave.
Well, let's start with a topic that voters on both sides of the state line surely have noticed, and that is President Obama's declining popularity across the country. Maybe the obvious question, Bert, how much has the disastrous rollout of Obamacare hurt this president right now?
Well, I think it's clearly hurt him in terms of public opinion, the ratings. There's no question. I mean, this has been a disaster. It was covered up a bit early on by the government shutdown, but once people turned to focus on Obamacare, no question it's a disaster. And the administration, I thought, was very slow, including former Governor Sebelius, very slow to sort of admit that up front. And cause I think there were, you know, you don't know what happened behind the scenes, but for a couple, 3-4 weeks even, there was this kind of muddling through till they finally said, oh, yeah, I mean, we've got to do something.
You know, George Conner, what's amazing to me about this whole thing is how was it possible that the administration could, you know, launch this program, this huge program, knowing surely in so many quarters of the administration that there were big problems with it?
It strikes me as almost willful ignorance. you had to know, Steve. I think you're right. You know, at some levels of the administration, you had to know. So the question really is, how far did it get up the chain of command? You know, but they went ahead and did it anyway. But if you think back to the bill, you know, when the bill passed, most of the legislature didn't know what was in it either. And so, you know, there's an awful lot of blame to be, you know, be parsed out. But I think, as Bert said, most of it, you know, rests with the administration. And again, a lot of it with former Governor Sebelius.
Dave Helling from the Star, how much damage do you think has been done for this president with this rollout of this program?
Well, not only damaging to his presidency, but really damaging to the whole Democratic argument, Steve, in some ways, that we are the people that can make government work. I think that's what the biggest long-term danger is. They make the case that healthcare reform is necessary and that the government is the best possible organization to do that, and the rollout problems really call that into question. Now, let's be a little bit cautious. Second terms are always a mess.
You know, it should be abolished.
I mean, Ronald Reagan, the great hero of the right, his second term was Iran-Contra and Ollie North and all that stuff. You know, Bill Clinton was impeached, not convicted, but impeached his second term. So, you know, second terms are always problematic, and I don't think Barack Obama is immune from that syndrome either. Having said that, I do think that the rollout will cause him some short-term problems. The long-term problems I've already mentioned. And there's one other thing that I think the healthcare disaster has pointed out, and that is a lack of other accomplishments that Obama can really point to. If he were doing better legislatively on immigration reform or education reform or tax reform, yeah. You know, the budget is getting a little bit better, but by and large, that's something most people don't see. Instead, the only thing he can really talk about is healthcare. So when it goes poorly, it's an additional problem.
Now, let's veer off on a tangent here that Dr. Helling just raised, this notion of second terms, whether it's second terms for presidents, Bird Loomis, whether it's second terms for governors. Why do we have them? How many times do we have to beat our heads against the wall with one, you know, shoddy second term after another before we sit back and say maybe we should redo this system?
I can't point to a successful
second term.
Sure, I would. Well, Clinton, I think, was a successful second term.
But you're dealing with
a highly partisan legislature. It takes two to tango here, and one of the problems that Obama has is he's got a Congress that is totally deadlocked. I think that you do see problems in second terms, but the opposite would be to have a single term, maybe a six-year presidency.
Six-year, that's the obvious way to
go. The person is a lame duck from day one. And so everyone can – if you think now of a president being a lame duck for the last 4 years, you've really got a lame duck for 6 years. If you look at Mexico, for example, it's how much you could steal in 6 years, and then you're out. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think I think Clinton did have a decent 6 years. He left with a higher approval rating than Reagan did.
Mm-hmm.
In a sense, George Bush's last 2 or 3 years were better than his first five.
Hmm.
I think that it really is the skill of the individual. Eisenhower probably got a little tired, but he got the interstate highway done in his last – the space program turned around that Kennedy then could benefit from. I think we need to be a little circumspect here. I guess what I do think is that the other question we ought to ask is, what difference does Obama's popularity at 39 – or 45 or 52% make right now? I think we know that presidential popularity makes very little difference in terms of what Congress does.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly this Congress.
And second terms typically focus more on foreign policy. You
yeah.
see him working on Iran, right?
Yeah.
Iran and Syria, for example, might end up being successes. And the other thing is we really need to suspend judgment on how well this is going to work as of 2015, 2016. You're beginning to see some indications that it might be working better. And one of the problems here is that you've had a Republican Party that's apparent raison d'etre right now is to criticize Obamacare. It has nothing else going for it
in terms of a
program.
That was my next question. George Conner, Republicans simply have not let up on this issue. They've been critical of it since before it passed and now long after it was passed. They clearly see this as a winning issue for them. Is it, in your view?
Well, I think it depends on what state we're in. I mean, I think, as Byrd said, we're starting to see some successes, and some states have had a better track record with the rollout than others. But I think ultimately, you know, there is, I think Byrd is right, we have to wait and see for a couple more years. I think the Republicans are skating on very thin ice, you know, hoping that this is going to fail. Because they're putting all their eggs into one basket. And I think, you know, the other point about Iran may be successful, Syria may be successful. At the end, the Republicans may be left holding an empty bag, you know, the pig mm-hmm. and the Pope. I mean, it's anti-Obamacare will work in Missouri. Anti-Obamacare will work in Kansas. Anti-Obamacare will work in this congressional district or that congressional district. But I think there's a great danger of trying to ride that horse into retaking the Senate and taking the presidency.
Can I just real quickly
yes,
say, I agree with everything that George and Bert have said.
Oh, you always do.
particularly about the Republican thin ice. I do think that, you know, the approval rating for Congress is, you know, in single digits. That's never a good thing. I do think the Obama administration made a political mistake, not on the merits of the health care law, but a political mistake by not, in essence, making an argument 6 months, a year ago that the Republicans were being intransigent and were damaging the possibility of a successful implementation of that law. They sort of said it in the breach, but I would have done a more sustained argument that said, look, this thing isn't going to work if it doesn't work in part because the Republicans are blocking significant parts of it. Medicaid expansion is now optional because of the Supreme Court. That is an enormous problem with what the Affordable Care Act promised, which is near universal health insurance coverage. Because states like Kansas and Missouri have chosen not to expand Medicaid, that's an enormous problem. Second, the website problems with the exchange are due in part to the fact that states didn't set up exchanges.
Mm-hmm.
Missouri was supposed to have its own exchange, so was Kansas. Another two dozen states decided to let the federal government perform that function. That's one reason for the foul up with the rollout in October. So you know, politically, had the Democrats and the administration said, in essence, look, we're trying to get this done, but you Republicans are blocking the way. Therefore, it is not going to be as smooth as everyone would want it to be, might have been a winner. Now it's too late. Now the horse is kind of out of the barn. It's very difficult to make that argument.
Well, speaking of horses out of the barn, what do we know here at this point, George, about this notion that the person perhaps most directly responsible for the rollout of Obamacare was former Kansas Governor Kathleen Sebelius? I mean, before all this, she had this reputation as steady, as capable, as politically very astute. How do people view her now, George?
Well, I think she's lost the luster. I mean, I think you're right. Going in, you know, it was a smart move by President Obama to make that selection, but she has shouldered the lion's share of the blame, and it's difficult to tell whether she's falling on her sword, you know, accepting the blame, you know, for taking one for the team, or she actually is in fact responsible. But my assessment, you know, based on, you know, what we see in the public, what we see in the response to this, is that, you know, what was a rising star, you know, a continuing rising star, is now on the decline.
You know, Bird, you've worked for her. You know, this is not a woman who suffers fools. And you sort of, I can't help but watch her as she sort of twists in the wind out there. And I can't help but think this must be an extraordinarily difficult time for her.
Oh geez. Yes, you can't. It's hard to imagine, to tell you the truth. I think she's performing pretty much the way I would have expected her to. She's a pro. She knows how to take responsibility.
George's point out, she's taken it, but she hasn't taken it, you know?
But I think that's actually the truth of the matter. For one thing, it's pretty clear that a lot of this has been run out of the White House. And so the Governor Sebelius doesn't have quite the control that we think. And we've talked about the administration here. Once you get into the weeds on this, you're talking about several private contractors. You're talking about the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid. You're talking about the White House. You're talking about HHS. Suddenly the administration doesn't look like some coherent whole, but you're looking at bureaucratic politics of the first order. And I think that something that Dave mentioned here early on is that you've got an incredibly complex, difficult healthcare system in this country that we really, you know, need to do something about. Put on top of that this incredibly difficult, complex piece of legislation. It's pretty clear right now that you have a hard time making those fit in the best of circumstances, and these clearly were not the best of circumstances.
Yeah. Dave Helling, how much damage can she ever turn this around? You know, having gone through this experience, will she emerge in some way, assuming she doesn't last out the entire duration of the second term of President Obama? Can she overcome this and sort of emerge as still a shining knight somehow, or is it too late?
No, I think it's probably too late, at least in terms of a national profile for Kathleen Sebelius. Now, I think she will stay in the job as long as she wants to stay, frankly, because I'm not sure that any replacement could be confirmed by the Senate. It would be a nightmare, particularly after 2014, if the Republicans pick up any more strength in the Senate. And plus, you get the sense, I reported this story out about 3 weeks ago, you do get the sense that Obama sort of needs someone like her to stay in that place because she understands it better than maybe any potential replacement would. But I do think I'm fascinated by the fact that Kathleen Sebelius doesn't seem to have a natural political constituency in Washington. I mean, she's not of Washington, so she doesn't, you know, she doesn't have a sort of natural support in the Senate, natural support from the community, if you will, in Washington, like, say, a Tom Daschle might have had. You remember Daschle was the original nominee and stepped away. It's not clear to me how much pull Kathleen Sebelius ever had within the White House. I mean, there were other people assigned to health care reform, both in passing it and then implementing it. She's out on an island a little bit in ways that most cabinet secretaries aren't. So I'm not sure all of the blame for this problem rests in her lap.
But one quick thing here. I think she has one constituent, and that's
right.
I think they do have a very good relationship. It might be a little less good right now. But they have a very good relationship. I think in many ways they're not dissimilar people.
Exactly.
Cerebral. But in the end, I think that Her political skills in Kansas were pretty good as governor. I think they've been pretty good, but you're right about the constituency. On the other hand, there are other cabinet members, Steve Chu, for example,
right. who doesn't have one either.
Who didn't get it at all. So it's a tough environment. It's maybe the toughest thing the cabinet secretary has had to do for a while.
I want to get our listeners to chime in on President Obama's sort of fate here as he navigates his second term. If you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888. Again, 816-235-2888. You can also email us at updatedate@kcur.org or tweet us at @KCURUpToDate. We're talking this morning with our political pundits, Dave Helling from The Star, KU's Burdette Loomis, Missouri State University's George Conner. I want to move back for a moment to President Obama, George Conner. And you know, presidents for sure bounce up and down in the polls all the time. Bird has already pointed that out. But you do begin to develop a sense that, as Dave has said, with this particular Congress at work, at such loggerheads, it's an historically non-productive Congress. 60 bills passed, I think, signed into law. Nothing's ever come close to a Congress that's been this unproductive. I'm just wondering what the way forward is for President Obama. What can he do to sort of get his mojo back here as he moves forward through the second term? Or is he sort of done? What's your sense?
Well, my sense, to be honest, he's closer to done than moving forward.
I sort of agree with that. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think as we said earlier, there are some, rays of hope out there. Maybe there's a deal with Iran, but that's being criticized. Maybe there's a deal with Syria, but that's not, going to fly. Is there something on the horizon that we can, latch on to that he can ride, to a more successful term? As Bert said about, the second President Bush, it's possible that it's out there, but it does seem like the Affordable Health Care, the Affordable Care Act rollout is the sign of a diminishing presidency. It's not something that he's going to be able to build on. It's as if the sand under his feet, is going back into the ocean.
Any disagreement with that?
No, I mean, were I Barack Obama, I think that I would push all my chips in on the 2014 elections. I mean, I think the last chance he has to really salvage the second term after the rollout problems with ACA is to get working majorities in Congress. As long as we have split government and Republicans who are just absolutely opposed to helping him accomplish anything, and let's just face it, that's what their argument.
But he will get the House back, surely.
Well,
the Senate,
Senate
will be tough enough to hang on to that,
right.
Won't it?
If he does, you're right. Typically the 6-year election, the party controlling the White House loses seats. And if that happens, then I think George is right. There is, the second term is going to dwindle, run out of breath. But, so that's why I would gamble. I would say, look, I need to get out there, do a Harry Truman, do nothing Congress, and see if I can win some seats in the House and win some seats in the Senate. It's a long shot, but it may be the only shot he has.
Yeah, I would have thought that argument would hold a lot more water on October 15th when the Congress was still bucking the president, yeah. Government shut down. There you began to hear talk of Democratic House possibly.
But boy, that's gone now.
I think that's gone now. And I think we're really now increasingly talking about the Obama legacy as opposed to getting something done. And in terms of eggs and baskets, I think that his legacy is so much on the Affordable Health Care Act,
yeah.
that in a sense, if I were to put eggs in baskets, I would throw, as they've been doing for the last month, I would throw those eggs into getting that Health Care Act implemented as best as possible.
Yeah, just very quickly, let me turn the tables, ask a question, Bird and George.
Yeah, that's my job.
If today, if what we know about Barack Obama's presidency is sort of what we know today, obviously the next 2 years, we're not sure, is this a failed presidency or a successful presidency?
I'll let Bird go first.
Thanks,
George.
I'll say that to the public at large, it's probably a failed presidency. I think to presidential scholars, congressional scholars who look at it, it would be on the cusp 50-50. Because I do think that getting the Affordable Health Care Act was really substantial, and far undervalued is the amount of stimulus that he got early on, to maybe avoid a Europe-like depression.
Although maybe any president might have gotten that, though, given the circumstances. George, what's your take on that?
Well, I'm glad that Bert spoke first, because I would essentially say the same thing, because I think that the public at large, which is where it counts, and I think this is what cuts against Dave's argument, at the public at large, it's a failed presidency already. And so I think doing the Harry Truman routine, you know, isn't going to get him very far. It's going to put the microscope on the failures as opposed to the successes. But, you know, I think ultimately we will look back. And again, I agree with Bert. If I'm going to put my eggs in the basket, I'm looking at my legacy right now. And I would like to be Barack Obama 10 years down the road and say, you know, the public may not have liked me at this point, but I got America's healthcare system in working order. More people are, you know, getting medical care. People are not going to the emergency rooms. I would be looking at my legacy and putting all of my efforts into that one thing.
David?
Yeah. Just very quickly, the reason that's important is if Barack Obama is considered a failure or his presidency is considered a failure, the key lesson that Democrats would take from that is to succeed in government, you must make the occupant of the White House a failure.
Well, that's right.
And so, burn down the House. And that's the lesson the Republicans will have taught all political actors over the last 8 years. And that has enormous implications for our government.
Tim Egan, who wrote about the Dust Bowl, wonderful book about the Dust Bowl, writes for the New York Times. And he had a great column, editorial on hoping to fail. And that, to me, as someone who is an academic studying, you can't hope that the regime fails. You can oppose the regime.
But that's exactly where we're at, though.
It's absolutely where we're at, and that is not a good place for a small-D democracy.
You know, we'll talk in just a minute about the impact that Obamacare and its failure, at least in terms of the rollout, could have on the Kansas governor's race between Paul Davis and Sam Brownback next year. Let's go to some phone calls here, and Jimmy from Kansas City, Missouri. Jimmy, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Good morning. I just wanted to comment and get your opinion on the Sebelius bounce back issue, whether she would have a national presence, prospects for a good national presence. I think back on Hillary Clinton, who also was only First Lady of Arkansas. She didn't have a Washington constituency. It was a debacle of a healthcare legislation attempt in the Clinton administration, to which she took much of the blame, and then light bulbs and all of that, and look how she's bounced back. So I think Sebelius has that kind of savvy, that kind of intellect, that her prospects might be good.
Jimmy, I appreciate the phone call. Thank you. Again, our number, 816-235-2888. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll talk about the Kansas governor's race. We'll talk about the special session in Missouri and something that Dave Helling now calls the political industrial complex. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed yesterday's conversation about the future of the arts in Kansas City or our Texperts gift ideas for the nerd in your life, you can find those in all of our previous broadcasts. Just go to kcur.org. Tomorrow on the program, a look at domestic abuse in Kansas City and its connection to higher rates of chronic illness, plus a pair of sports reporters analyze the strengths and weaknesses of the teams meeting in this weekend's MLS Cup, including our own team here in Kansas City. Our phone number here, we're visiting with our political pundits, 816-235-2888. Our email address, updatedate@kcur.org. We're visiting with KU's Burdette Loomis, Missouri State University's George Connor, and the Star's Dave Helling. Let's turn to the governor's race in Kansas, because we have this burgeoning governor's race between incumbent Sam Brownback and a Democrat, the House Minority Leader. His name is Paul Davis. He's from Lawrence. I just wrote that the political convention wisdom in this race has shifted from Davis having no chance whatsoever to maybe having one shot in four or five. Do you buy that? I mean, to what extent are we going to have a race here in your view?
No, I think 4 years ago with Tom Holland, there was no chance. And this, I think,
just not much of a candidate.
I think from the beginning, Paul Davis has had a chance. Now, whether it's 1 in 7, 1 in 8, maybe now 1 in 4.
Yeah.
But it's a real chance. And that's because you have a governor with a record. And Democrats do well in Kansas running against governors with records.
Mm-hmm.
And so Robert Bennett lost. Mike Hayden lost. You can beat a governor with a record. And I think Paul Davis, who I've known personally since he was about 4 or 5 years old, know his father very well. Indeed. But Paul Davis, from the very beginning, has been extraordinarily serious about this. He's got real experts on his team. He's raised a decent amount of money, but he's really, really working at it. And I think a lot of people were skeptical to begin with. Oh, who's Paul Davis? We ought to get Jill Dawkins. We ought to get Sandy Prager to change party. But Paul Davis has this real desire, and he's operating at a very professional level, step by step. Now, whether that will win or not in a very Republican state, I don't know. But he's put down the base, the foundation for a campaign that can win. And historically, I've been very impressed because there's a seriousness of purpose about him that I think he's always believed that the brownback negatives are real, and that a good candidate can win.
You know, Dave Helling, so much to ask about here. I mean, the Brownback team has been criticizing the media in general for months for reporting about poll numbers that suggest that Governor Brownback isn't all that popular. And yet, boy, the poll numbers keep coming very consistently to suggest just what Bird said, that Governor Brownback indeed might have a problem.
Well, he'll have a race. There's no question about that. That wasn't clear 6 months ago, but I think Paul Davis and Jill Dawkins will provide a race. Again, Bird is right. Whether he can win or not, we'll see. But the other thing that Bird said is so important, and that is that second terms are always in some sense a referendum on the first term. And in Sam Brownback's case, not only does he have a record, but he has a measurable record, which is to say that he cut taxes. I mean, that's the signature accomplishment of his first term as governor. We are seeing the rollout of that tax cut now. And the evidence that it is working or not working is pretty compelling, at least through the first year, that it is not doing what he said it would do, which is mm-hmm. grow employment in the state and, in essence, raise revenue over time. That's the supply side argument, that if we cut taxes, more revenue will come in. Through the first 5 months, I think, of the fiscal year, revenue's down overall about 10% in the state of Kansas, mm-hmm. which is a huge hit to the state budget. It was projected, but to be that low. But projections are one thing; reality is yet another. And employment, at least according to some statistical measures, is actually below where it was before the tax cuts took effect in the state. So, if Paul Davis is to have a chance, he'll be able to run not only against sort of a the overall record, but the very specifics of what Sam Brown.
But what a mountain Paul Davis has got to climb. I mean, you can easily tag Paul Davis as being a liberal from Lawrence. You're easily going to tag him with having been supportive of President Obama, who was roundly unpopular in Kansas. And then I guess also, Bird, you're going to have this notion that Kathleen Sebelius' struggles with Obamacare in Washington, being the last elected Democratic governor in Kansas, could spill over and cause problems for Paul Davis in this campaign, no question.
Yeah, I think all of those things are true, and you haven't even mentioned the real elephant in the room, which is X million dollars in money from the Kochs or their groups.
That'll float a Brownback, yeah.
But that said, there's a great Barney Frank quote that he'll take votes over money anytime. And a month ago, the Brownback numbers went from 35 positive, 48 negative, to 35 positive, 58 negative. Mm-hmm. So people who were learning about Brownback were moving away from him.
Mm-hmm.
I also think you've got these constituencies, particularly the educational constituency, that's very skeptical. And you may well have Sam Brownback in the middle of a school finance brouhaha here, where he and the legislature may well defy the Supreme Court. Now, I don't know how that's going to play out politically,
mm-hmm.
but my guess is a governor defying the Supreme Court does not necessarily look that great. And so I go back and I say all those things are true about Paul Davis, the Lawrence liberal, the Obama, and those aren't positives. But to the extent that the focus goes back onto Brownback, those things may matter less than they would in another environment.
We should have that ruling from the Kansas Supreme Court any
maybe
day now.
Maybe December, January,
sometime here soon. I want to get back to George Conner over in Missouri. You know, George, it's only December, but Missouri lawmakers are back in session this week. On Friday, Governor Nixon called the Missouri General Assembly back into session to consider a $150 million package of incentives in an effort to win a new assembly line or two at the Boeing plant over in eastern Missouri. I'm hearing, George, that this proposal has an awfully steep climb ahead of it. What do you think?
But I think it has a steep climb mainly in because of the short time frame. I mean, Boeing has set a very short deadline. The governor has a package in mind, but it doesn't appear that the legislature, you know, in the House and the Senate have seen much detail on it. And so I think just putting together a package that would be competitive with all the other states that are doing the exact same thing in a short period of time, you know, is difficult. And then on top of that, you know, we have been for the last 2, 3, 4 years debating the value of these tax credits. I mean, part it's a tension between the Republicans in the House and Republicans in the Senate, but also tension between the governor and the legislature itself. And we've done this before. We had a Canadian company we were competing to bring a plant to Missouri, and we went through this very same exercise to no avail. So I think that the political controversy over tax incentives in general, plus the short time frame, are going to make this a very difficult prospect.
You know, Dave Helen, we just had an election in Kansas City at which voters took a look at this idea of giving tax dollars to private entities. It didn't work in the translational medicine tax that went down last month. You wonder how something like this will fly in Missouri on a statewide basis.
Right, although, you know, the Missouri lawmakers did approve a package for the Claycomo plan. I mean, the idea of subsidizing businesses, particularly through tax credits, is not new in Missouri, as George points out. But you do get the sense that, you know, voters are skeptical about these ideas of using public money to subsidize private businesses. The translational tax was a little more ephemeral than a Boeing plan, obviously. But it's not a slam dunk. It is not a slam dunk. Not only that, but there are Republicans in Missouri who see this freight train leaving and think, hey, let's put right to work on there. Let's put some, you know, other legislation on there that we've been trying for several years. That muddies the waters even more. It's a long shot. Now, you know, you can't really criticize Jay Nixon maybe for going for it because of the potential involved, but it is not a slam dunk.
You know, George Conner, just looking ahead to the legislative session that launches in January, Governor Nixon, you know, in round terms, he wants more money for public schools and colleges and universities. Republican lawmakers, though, are saying they want more money. They want to cut taxes with that money. How is this going to play out?
Well, I think, as it has played out for the last couple of years, we'll be at stalemate on those issues. I don't think the legislature is going to budge with respect to funding. I mean, in part, it's not just Governor Nixon versus the legislature. As I said a moment ago, it's the Republicans in the Senate versus the Republicans in the House. And there may be some sympathy for, you know, the funding formula, whether it's K-12 or universities. But ultimately, I think Governor Nixon is at one point on the scale and the Republicans in the legislature are at another point. And it doesn't appear that compromise is something that they're actually working towards.
Mm-hmm. On Sunday, my colleague Dave Helling, who's here in the studio with us this morning, had a terrific story about something called the political industrial complex. David, what is it and why should we be concerned about it?
Well, thanks for reading, by the way. The political industrial complex. Politics is a lot of things. It's how we govern ourselves. It's small d democracy, as Bird calls it. But it's also a business. It's a very lucrative business for those who are in it. And what we tried to take a look at is the entire panoply of politically related businesses: polling, consulting, you know, yard sign making, all the things that are connected with how voters make their minds up. You know, negative campaigns have been a part of our country pretty much forever. I mean, really, you go back to the late 1700s, early 1800s, it was brutal. What I think is different and what we want to keep an eye on a little bit is a couple of things. First, the enormous amount of money now involved in politics, $10 billion in last year, presidential year, but $10 billion for all of these things. And the increasing sophistication of consultants and others who can target messages, negative messages that often make compromise much more difficult once these men and women are elected and go to whatever office they're going to hold. That's one problem. And then the other thing I think we tried to examine is a fear from some observers that the tactics of elections pushed by consultants has started to leak rather significantly into how we govern. And Bird was talking earlier about the House and the real dysfunction in the U.S. House. And you can find people who will say that's because the House is now run like a campaign, mm-hmm. and that bills are proposed not because they would make good law, but because they would make a campaign point and show up in television ads that consultants and ad makers would put together. So when you combine those two phenomena, the enormous amount of money, sophistication of the industry, and the idea that it's leaking over into government, it's at least a partial explanation for some of the dysfunction we see at all levels of government, but particularly in Washington.
You know, Burdette Loomis from KU, you spent some time studying what Dave calls the political industrial complex. You know, you go back to the mid-1970s and Jimmy Carter's campaign, he had a pollster named Pat Caddell who sort of coined this phrase, which was the permanent campaign, this idea that you will govern as you campaign, you're always trying to win points and that kind of thing. What do you make of this project, this notion of the political industrial complex, and how big a potential problem it can be for our democracy out there?
I just screened a documentary yesterday in a class called Primary of 1960.
Huh.
And you could see,
it
was Humphrey versus Kennedy in Wisconsin.
Yeah.
And you could see the Kennedys, things were beginning to change. Fast forward to the 1970s, you have Pat Caddell and those guys. I actually think it was Sid Blumenthal who coined the phrase permanent campaign, mm-hmm. but everybody got it.
Mm-hmm.
That would look positively quaint today. We're talking about people raising tens of millions of dollars for Hillary Clinton, separate from her own ambitions, 4 years out from 3 years out from the presidential campaign. You're talking about very large sums of money coming in for a referendum. Referenda are
right.
Incredible.
Big money.
Petition drives
and,
as well.
And so what you have is industry, and it leaches over into lobbying very much too, often run publicly. So you're now talking about maybe $8 to $10 billion in election years, but the lobbying industry year in year out is doing $8 billion,
mm-hmm.
and so the amount of money here is massive. The stakes are really really high, so in 1970s you might have had 5-7 polling firms in D.C. You
mm-hmm.
have 60 now.
Mm-hmm.
You have fundraising firms, and Dave just touches the tip of the iceberg here mm-hmm. in terms of specialties, yard sign people. Political accountants,
mm-hmm.
Huge firms, or maybe huge specialties here. I think
hard money, soft money,
and how to account for the money coming in.
Yeah.
And my takeaway from this, and this is when I was looking at this 10 years ago, even more so today, so many people have a stake in how it's done right now. If you read This Town about D.C.,
yes.
That's what it's about.
Mark Leibovich was here.
It's about the money, and it's kind of self-perpetuating. What's really remarkable to me is, as your story pointed out, in a very short time frame, they needed $1 million. That did not seem to be a problem. We'll get $1 million.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll get two. Within 3 weeks, we needed another $1 million.
It's always remarkable to me that the money is out there to pour in.
You know, George Conner, Dave Helling's piece focused a little bit on the translational medicine tax here in Kansas City, and that's what Bird was just referring to, this. You need $1 million, no problem, we'll have it to you. But in Missouri in recent years, you can almost divide up the statewide candidates, the members of the legislature, by whose consultant was working on their campaign. Dave Barklage had his stable of lawmakers, Jeff Rowe did, John Hancock does. What do you make of it? How has it impacted politics in Jeff City?
Well, I think my takeaway on that story, you know, the insidious relationship between these two groups, the governing side and the election side, really focused not so much on the stable of, you know, left and right, you know, as you pointed out with Roe and Hancock and so on. I think the concern that Dave, again, just touched the iceberg on, was you think about Rod Jetton and his consulting firm, or Paul Lavoda and his brother and their consulting. You have people who are actually in the legislature.
Yes.
Doing consulting, you know, for their colleagues, and you know that
the former
was,
Speaker of the House was a consultant while he was Speaker, George.
Right.
Was,
I mean, yeah. So for Jetton, it was pay to play, you know, and that, you know, nothing came of the FBI investigation, but it raises, you know, lots of eyebrows, and we even saw this with Speaker Jones, and you know, is there a smoke behind the Missouri Freedom Alliance, or is it just, you know, something innocuous? And so I think the part-timeness nature of Missouri's legislature, you know, the fact that they're not professional politicians, you know, lends more, you know, they're going to rely more on these type of campaigns and these kinds of professionals.
Yeah. The other thing that's insidious, and both Bird and George touched on this, is the idea that people cross the line all the time, that the lines between lobbying, consulting, and elected officials are blurring dramatically, so that, for example, Bird talked about lobbying. Well, lobbying is not just going in and talking with a lawmaker anymore. It's mounting statewide campaigns, which are then run by consultants who know fundraisers, who buy ad time. All of the actors in the system have a financial incentive to keep it going, mm-hmm. because there's plenty of money around for everybody.
And David, you pointed out in your piece that not only is that dynamic at play, but once these lawmakers get elected, the consultants who elected them sometimes advise them on how to vote once they're in office,
right.
with obviously a very political component attached to those decisions.
Right. And that's what I think most people fear, that in essence lawmaking used to be that elections, you had your election and then you made laws for 18 months and then you had another election. But now with the permanent campaign, the sophistication, the amount of money involved, in essence, you have lawmakers making decisions not based on what they may or may not think is the most important thing for their country or their districts, but what will get them elected next time. And they have very highly paid people telling them what that is.
Okay. These folks have very highly paid people telling them what to do. In Jackson County last month, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars spent to pass this translational research tax. It wound up getting 18% of the vote, even though some of the best, quotes around the word best, consultants in Missouri were working to pass that tax. 18%, David, how can that happen?
Yeah, I think it may have been a little less than 18%. Well, because the voters still have their say. Now, what Jeff Rowe and Axiom and other people will tell you is they lost because there was an organized opposition. And because, you know, they expected to sort of – the $1 million would be fine because they wouldn't have anybody against the tax.
But lo and behold,
they got some opposition, so they doubled their side. $1 million was spent against them. You know, at the end of that story, we talk to people who say, look, there is some snake oil in all of this. You know, consultants aren't perfect. Somebody wins and somebody loses almost every time. And I think the translational tax is a perfect example of that. But the translational tax will not dissuade actors in the system from trying again in some other way at some other time. And when that happens, the consultants and the rest of the political industrial complex are going to make money.
Let me give a phone call here from Phil Cartarella. Phil, good morning to you.
Hi there.
Hey, Phil.
Thanks.
They said of Hughes, the multimillionaire, that his father noticed that it didn't matter when everybody came to Texas and drilled for oil, and some found it and some didn't, but everybody needed to buy drills, and that's how he became a billionaire. So the real question is, with a lot of consultants, it really doesn't matter whether or not it's a good idea or a bad idea. The only issue is, can somebody be talked into spending the money?
Bert, you share that view, Phil's view there?
Pretty much so. I mean, I think that right now we are in the Wild West of campaign lobbying expenditures, that in the wake of Citizens United, there are essentially no effective campaign finance laws on the books. Now, you can get sent away for not filling out your forms right.
But you've also found in your research that as you talk to these consultants, most of them sort of believe in the people they're working
sure
for.
Sure they do. No, there's no question. But I think the point is that to do your analogy, you got a lot of drillers down there. So I think that the point is that there are so many folks that you can find someone who will work with you. And a big part of this whole entity of your complex is they're doing a lot of marketing all the time. They're always on the come looking for that next client.
We're out of time for our political pundits. I want to thank the stars, Dave Helling, Burdette Loomis from KU, and George Conner, who joined us on the phone this morning from Missouri State University down in Springfield. Gentlemen, always a pleasure to have you all here. Thanks so much for your time
today.
Thanks,
Steve.
Thank you, Steve.